You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for climate action on the climate emergency.
Today, we are speaking with Doreen Stabinski, lead author of the recent Friends of the Earth International report entitled Chasing Carbon Unicorns, The Deception of Carbon Markets and Net Zero. Doreen is currently professor of global environmental politics at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. Her primary area of research, policy analysis, and advocacy is at the nexus between climate change, agriculture, and food security. Her most recent publications include Environmental Politics for a Changing World, Power, Perspectives, and Practice, and it's written with Ronnie Lipschultz, and Missing Pathways to 1.5 Degrees Celsius, The Role of the Land Sector in Ambitious Climate Action. Doreen, welcome to The Rebellion.
Thanks. So nice to be here.
You know, I want to begin with the last part of this report. And let me just say this, you know, some of these reports, they make my eyes glaze over. But this one I could not put down. And it was powerfully written and I just could not put it down. And so I want to start with this last part of this report where it states that corporations are calling upon nature to, quote, provide a solution to their desire to continue with emissions as usual. Global corporations are leading the way on this strategy to rely on nature and governments are following. This house of cards will go up in flames with all of us in it, end quote. So let's talk about this house of cards for a minute. What makes corporations' reliance upon nature to continue with emissions a house of cards? And what does net zero have to do with it? I mean, why is a reliance on nature a problem?
Well, so I guess I would start with this idea of net zero, right? So, you know, if we want to keep temperatures below 1.5, we have to stop burning fossil fuels. We just have to stop burning fossil fuels, right? There's no option there. We've already committed enough of infrastructure, et cetera, to get us to 1.5, even if we just like stopped emitting today. But we're going to have residual emissions, right? So even if we get to zero burning of fossil fuels, there's a lot of human activity that's still going to create emissions. And when we create those emissions, we're going to need to somehow balance out those emissions. And we look to nature to balance out those emissions, right? We look to trees, to natural ecosystems, to take up carbon dioxide that will be emitted in the normal, you know, even if we're not burning fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So that's a given. Net zero also, so the idea of net zero is that after 2050, well, this is what net zero pledges to 2050 state, that at some point we're going to have a balance. We're going to have a balance of emissions and removals, but those emissions have to be as close to zero as possible because we don't have the capacity in our natural ecosystems to remove very much.
Right.
And what corporations and what governments are doing is they're using this idea of nature and the possibility of nature to draw down carbon dioxide emissions. They're doing that in sort of a smokescreeny way. They're deceiving us in thinking that, well, nature's got this great capacity. We can just continue to burn fossil fuels. And that's the house of cards, right? Those structures that allow the continuation of the burning of fossil fuels with the idea that nature's going to soak it all up. When in fact, we've got to actually get to zero in order for nature to be able to help us out.
Okay, so back up a second. What, as a definition, what does net zero emissions mean?
Okay, well, you can look at the two parts of that phrase, right? There's the net and there's the zero. There's too much emphasis on the net. The net is that balance between emissions and removals. The net is there's going to be some emissions, which is a positive number, some removals in trees and soils, whatever, as a negative number. And you balance that out and you get to zero. Emissions minus removals equals zero. But the bigger problem is if you ask for nature to do too many removals, right? Okay. The problem is that equation, the emissions have to get as close to zero as possible for us to have the ability to remove those emissions, right? And what we're being deceived into thinking is that those emissions can be as great as possible because nature is wonderful and we're just going to plant a billion trees.
So your report, and you've already alluded to it in our conversation today, your report calls for real zero. And, you know, it might be similar to what there's Extinction Rebellion literature that talks about absolute zero. These might be similar concepts. But tell us what you mean exactly by real zero and why do we have to do real zero instead of net zero?
I mean, I have to say that real zero is a theoretical, it's something theoretical that we strive for. We need to, in that phrase net zero, we've got to put the emphasis on the zero. Mm-hmm. We've got to put the emphasis on the zero because there isn't a lot of nature out there that's going to help us with that net. And that's real zero, right? Real zero is a real commitment to decarbonize economies. It's a real commitment to stop burning fossil fuels. Like, that's it. No more fossil fuels. That's what real zero is. It's a recognition that that's where we have to head to. And, you know, yeah, nature's going to help us out along the way, but nature's not a solution, right? And nature's being posited as this solution by corporations. I mean, fossil fuel, can you imagine? Fossil fuel corporations are calling, you know, they're saying that they've got net zero oil shipments and carbon neutral natural gas shipments. The idea that you can continue to burn and ship fossil fuels around the planet because someone somewhere is planting trees is a fantastic story. That is the house of cards, right? That puts us torches the planet.
You know, I was reading an article recently in the climate change news, and the byline is Saudi Arabia will generate 50% of its energy from renewables by 2030 and plant 10 billion trees in coming decade. Its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has announced it's going to continue to, of course, drill and drill and drill, but at least it's going to plant those 10 billion trees. You know, what will it take for us to actually reach real zero in the ways that you've defined real zero?
I mean, getting to real zero means electrifying our transport, means massive transformation of our transportation system to where we've got public transport. It means massively reducing demand for energy by retrofitting houses. It means, you know, transforming an industrial agricultural system, which is, you know, responsible for lots of methane and nitrous oxide emissions. I mean, it does require a sort of massive transformations, but it's the only answer that we have to climate change, right? Unless you want to create some fanciful ideas of, you know, the report's called Chasing Carbon Unicorns, because some of the other proposals are that there's some technological solutions that somehow are going to save us from climate change.
So we've got net zero and real zero as competing approaches to the climate crisis. Let's talk about the interests that are behind the net zero approach. One might name some corporations. One might even name some nonprofit organizations. One might name governments, especially of the larger countries. Are these interests coordinating with each other? Oh, and did I miss any that are important that you want to mention? But are these interests coordinating with each other? If so, how? Can you give us some examples?
I mean, I guess I'd add some folks in there, you know, so someone like Mark Carney, who's got a task force on scaling voluntary carbon markets. Mark Carney is a former governor of the Bank of England. So you have the bank and finance sector, and maybe you can add those to the list of corporations. And then you've got the carbon marketeers. I mean, the folks who are going to be buying and selling these sort of nature-based carbon offsets that are sort of foundational for this like net zero economy. Are they coordinating? I mean, I think that they are. There's similar messages out there. There's similar talking points. There is certainly work on the part of, you know, there's a handful of non-governmental organizations, some of the more conservative non-governmental organizations in the U.S., like the Environmental Defense Fund and Nature Conservancy. Those folks who have for a long time been proponents of carbon markets see this as a boon, and confirming that they knew all along that carbon markets were going to save forests and forests were going to save the planet. I mean, but it's based on really false assumptions or, you know, false understanding of the nature of carbon and what we have to do in order to stay below 1.5.
You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. And we're speaking with Doreen Stabinski, lead author of the Friends of the Earth International report, Chasing Carbon Unicorns, The Deception of Carbon Markets and Net Zero. You know, on April 22nd of this year, the White House issued a statement claiming, among other things, that, quote, on day one, President Biden fulfilled his promise to join the Paris Agreement and set a course for the United States to tackle the climate crisis at home and abroad, reaching net zero emissions economy-wide by no later than 2050. Is that goal good enough?
Well, no. I started off by saying that net zero, I mean, you know, the idea of getting to net zero, yeah, we have to, real zero is a theoretical goal to achieve net zero, where we have a small amount of emissions and a small amount of removals balancing each other out by mid-century is a good thing, is what we're trying to strive for. It's important to remember that carbon dioxide accumulates in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And it accumulates and stays there for hundreds to thousands of years. So to be able to get to a point where we can have a small amount of emissions and a small amount of removals and still be below 1.5 means that we have to get to zero extremely rapidly, right? Because we've already got enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to get us to 1.5, right? We can't keep putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere until 2045. Exactly. And then all of a sudden in 2050 get to net zero and stay below 1.5, right? I mean, that's a recipe for well over 2 degrees of warming if you're continuing to emit. And so a 2050 net zero goal is meaningless. It's absolutely meaningless. What the goal, how we have to describe our actions is how quickly we're going to get to zero, right? That's the meaningful objective, right? Is like how we're going to get to zero, and this is how we're going to get to zero, and we're going to get to zero as quickly as possible. A 2050 net zero goal is saying, I haven't got a clue, and we're going to make it up as we go along, right? You know, because if we're getting to zero by 2030, it's way different for the climate than if we get to zero by 2045 or 2050.
Is that what you propose, 2030 as a goal, as a realistic goal for us to you know, thwart this crisis?
Getting to zero by 2030 is really, really difficult.
Yes.
But we've got to set those goals, right? Or we're not going to do it. It's meaningless to say, well, by 2050, we're going to be at net zero. No, we have to like figure out how we're going to incrementally, what are we going to do next year? What are we going to do the year after? How do we get to zero? Because unless we set those really, really difficult goals for us, we're just going to keep, you know, and what the White House and what other governments are doing is, you know, make like the Saudis making us imagine that if we just plant a billion trees somewhere, everything will be just fine. One of the initiatives worldwide, which I think is really, really important and helpful in thinking about what we have to do and how quickly we have to do it and how collaboratively we have to do it, is something called the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, mm-hmm. which is starting from the assumption that you have to stop burning fossil fuels, right? And the Paris Agreement doesn't start from that assumption. And this is a challenge of the current global environmental governance framework that we have right now. Exactly. The Non-Proliferation Treaty says, you know, it's sort of along the lines of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Number one, you have to stop all new production. Just stop. We shouldn't be financing coal plants. We shouldn't be building coal plants. You know, or oil. We shouldn't be building pipelines, right? Just stop and then agree on a global phase down. And that global phase out of fossil fuel production, we've all got to get on the same page, the Saudis, the US, you know, the rest of the world. How quickly are we going to phase out fossil fuel? And then the third component of that treaty is a just transition, because we can't do any of this unless it's done justly and equitably and making sure that, you know, people are taken care of in that transition. But we have to build a different world.
Absolutely.
Which is not based on fossil fuels. It takes a lot of effort, but it takes vision. And like, by just coming out and saying, well, we've got this 2050 net zero goal. I mean, that's not a vision at all, right?
Let's talk more about that just transition. Your report talks about the underlying equity issues involved in the net zero approach. And in fact, some of the wording implies that net zero is part of a continuous unfolding of colonial forms of domination. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, net zero, to the extent that the people who are least responsible for the climate catastrophe are currently the ones that are most exposed to climate violence right now, right? Mm-hmm. The violence of the impacts of climate change. You know, I mean, that should be a starting point in thinking about equity and justice in all of this, is those that are least responsible. You know, one of the things that net zero relies on, like, you know, when the Saudis say they're going to plant 10 billion trees, they're not planting those 10 billion trees in Saudi Arabia, right? Where are they going to plant those 10 billion trees? Whose land are they going to plant those 10 billion trees on, right? They're assuming that there's some vacant lot somewhere that they're going to plant a bunch of trees on. Those trees that, you know, the nature that is the solution to the fossil fuel problem of fossil fuel companies is usually the lands and forests of the developing world, right? It's usually the lands of those who don't necessarily have secure tenure over those lands, right? And it's the lands and forests of those who aren't responsible. And so you can expect, if, you know, if you create this market for carbon sequestration, if you create, and I mean, it's out there, if you grow this market where, you know, I could get to continue to drive my car because I've invested a little bit of money in somebody planting trees somewhere else. I mean, the value to me of that sequestration, or the value to a fossil fuel company of the public relations of being able to say, we've got these nice forests somewhere, that value is usually much greater than the value to those who are on those lands right now, growing food, small-scale food producers, indigenous peoples, right? And so the value of their carbon for me is much greater than what they can pay in order to stay on those lands, right? And so the effect is, we can imagine that the effect is large-scale land grabbing for carbon sequestration spaces around the world for those of us to continue with this, with our lifestyles that are based on fossil fuels.
And it's always presented as if these lands are empty, as if they're just there for us to use, and no one lives there and no one has ever lived there. And it's you know, classically colonialist. You know, the report states that what becomes crystal clear is that there is no desire or ambition on the part of the largest and richest market players in the world to actually reduce emissions. Greenwashing hardly suffices as a term to describe these efforts to obscure continued growth in fossil fuel emissions. Ecocide and genocide more accurately capture the impacts the world will face. You know, that's quite a statement.
Yeah, it is quite a statement. And it's, I think, sad but true. You know, if you look at these net zero plans, look, I mean, the fossil fuel companies are they understand the carbon cycle better than you and I understand.
They've been studying it and hiding their studies.
Exactly. You know, they absolutely, they're responsible for this perpetuation of this idea that somehow planting trees is going to make everything just fine. And because it won't, right? Because the physics of that, the biology of that, the geophysics of that means that we will have, you know, climate change well above 2 degrees, 3 degrees, right?
Right.
Their continued burning of fossil fuels means that people will die. And their continued burning of fossil fuels means that species and ecosystems will collapse, right? We cannot continue burning fossil fuels. And so any scheme that they've come up with to justify continued burning of fossil fuels, to enable them to continue business as usual, any scheme is necessarily a genocidal and an ecocidal scheme.
So they know what the stakes are. They know they are setting in motion ecocide and genocide, to use the language in your report, and yet they are doing everything in their power to prevent us from changing course. Where does that truth leave us? It seems to me that the report's observation is ultimately a call for a very powerful transnational resistance, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the resistance has just begun, but, you know, we've seen... You know, I think that the pipeline fights in the United States on indigenous territories, I mean, I think that those, you know, our indigenous brothers and sisters on the front lines have shown us like where we need to start, because we need to start with saying no to the fossil fuel infrastructure. But I also see that, I mean, I think that the struggles for climate justice, which are the struggles, you know, the struggles to stop climate change, they can't be separated from other struggles, right? So I see that, you know, as people are marching right now in the streets for a free Palestine, as we've seen folks marching for Black Lives Matter over the last, you know, year since the murder of George Floyd, I mean, those are struggles that are linked with the struggles of climate justice. I think that those struggles for energy justice and food justice, I mean, I think that all of those are really sort of interlinked. And so I don't see resistance against fossil fuel infrastructure. Like I see it all of a piece, right? And I think that that's really, that transnational resistance is resistance on a range of issues which are so interlinked and intersectional.
This is WBAI. You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Our guest this week is Doreen Stabinski, author of The Friends of the Earth's International Report, Chasing Carbon Unicorns, and she is a professor at the College of the Atlantic. Doreen, in talking about what this resistance should look like, it sounds a little bit, okay, a note of skepticism. It sounds a little bit like solve all the humanity's problems all at once and do it right away really, really fast.
Yeah, you know, and the world doesn't work that way. But I think that having a realistic assessment of the challenges ahead is an important place to start. Mm-hmm. And to recognize that we have to recognize that there's a lot of work ahead. Yeah, we have to reduce fossil fuel burning to zero. That doesn't happen overnight. But without that sort of vision of where we need to get to, we don't get on that path, right? We just make these vague platitudes of like, oh, we have a net zero goal for 2050. Aren't we? Isn't it wonderful? I mean, no, we have to like recognize that, we need to transform our energy system. We need to electrify our transportation system. We need to stop fossil fuel production, both in the United States and abroad. And, you know, it's hard to really hard, right? Yeah. Really hard to face the magnitude of that, which is why I come back to this point about compassion and care. We have to learn to do better at taking care of each other, because we're not going to get all of this done on the time frame that we need to get it done. And those feelings of compassion and care are going to help us focus on taking care of people along the way, right? Yes, and there's no other way, right? There's no way else but through.
And we should be unrealistic. I mean, realism is ideological, right? And it serves the interests of the ruling class to talk about what's realistic and what isn't. Realistic is net zero, right? Unrealistic is real zero, and real zero is what we need to get to.
Doreen Skibinski, yeah. Thank you very much for joining us this week.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
What ACT UPers had in common, these were people who were unable to sit out a historic cataclysm.
And if you look at footage from United in Anger of a Monday night meeting where there'd be 300 to 700 people at the Gay Center, you can see that it's mostly white gay men. But when you look at the work that people did, when they left that Monday night meeting, people were working in coalition with all kinds of communities and all kinds of organizations. There were people working with drug users and fighting for needle exchange, and there were people fighting for housing for homeless people. There were people working for incarcerated people with HIV. There were people working with mothers who were HIV positive.
Tune to OutFM from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, September 14th. For a two-hour fundraising special on the history of the direct action AIDS group, ACT UP, on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th, in New York City, come together for peaceful conversation on how to create a better tomorrow. Connect the dots from Assange to Mumia, COVID and climate, housing and policing, from Afghanistan to Yemen. We're building coalitions. Black Lives Matter and Code Pink to Extinction Rebellion and Veterans for Peace, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, and more. Join us Sunday, September 19th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Foley Square. I'm Zul, and I'm a whistleblower for justice, people, and planet. RisingTogether.info for more information.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI New York. The previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. Stay tuned for a special from Out FM. That's will air in about another 90 seconds or so. We Only Want the World with Sansara Teller will be back at its regular time next week. And I was asked by Sansara to announce this event that's happening at Revolutions Books. And so I will oblige. Wednesday, September 15th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Books, the 50th anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion. Author Jared Rymuth will present the graphic novel memoir Big Black Stand at Africa. Attica. Frank Big Black Smith was one of the heroic prisoners who took part of the 1971 rebellion. He told his story to Jared, who continued working on the book after Big Black's death in 2004. And that is happening at Revolution Books tomorrow, September 15th, and Revolution Books. I just wanted to give